From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Hi, my name is Doug, and I'm the mailman who flew in and landed in front of the Capitol building. I'm here to talk about campaign finance reform and more specifically the overall corruption that has resulted in a Congress that is working for special interests through lobbyists and not working for the people.
Last week, a U.S. postal carrier named Doug Hughes flew a gyrocopter onto the lawn of the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to deliver letters to every member of Congress calling for campaign finance reform. He was arrested and faces up to 4 years in jail. Today, he joins us while under house arrest in Florida. Then to Earth Day.
My baby at that time was small, and I was nursing him. He also felt sick. And after some tests, we discovered that he had high blood lead levels. And that's the first time that I actually decided to confront the issue.
We'll speak with Kenyan environmentalist Phyllis Omido, who campaigned to close a lead plant contaminating her community, and Burmese journalist Myint Zaw, an anti-dam campaigner. They are both winning the prestigious 2015 Goldman Prize for Environmental Activism. And then, how many more? A new report by Global Witness finds killings of environmental activists on the rise, with indigenous communities hardest hit. At least 116 environmentalists were killed last year, more than two a week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saudi Arabia's resumed airstrikes against Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen hours after announcing an end to its nearly month-long bombing campaign. The Saudi Defense Ministry said it would conclude the airstrikes and shift to a new strategy focused on a political solution. But after rebels gained ground in the central city of Taiz, the strikes resumed. Meanwhile, Tuesday, two airstrikes killed at least 40 people, most of them civilians. On Monday, the Committee to Protect Journalists reports a TV journalist and three staff members of the TV station Yemen Today were killed in an airstrike in the capital, Sana'a. A United Nations official has called for wealthy countries to collectively accept 1 million Syrian refugees over the next 5 years in order to curtail the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean Sea. UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights of Migrants, François Crapeau, told The Guardian the plan could also extend to Eritreans and other refugees who are fleeing from war. Over 1,750 migrants have died this year in the Mediterranean trying to reach Europe, 30 times higher than the same period last year. Libya says it's detained 600 migrants in the past few days after stopping boats poised to depart for Italy. French authorities say they've arrested a man suspected of planning an imminent attack on Paris churches. Officials say the man's an Algerian national who expressed a desire to travel to Syria. He's also suspected of murdering a woman before being detained Sunday when he allegedly shot himself by accident and called an ambulance. Authorities say they found a trove of weapons and notes about a planned attack in his car. In the United States, Senate lawmakers have reached a deal on an anti-abortion provision tucked into a human trafficking bill, paving the way for a Thursday vote on the stalled confirmation of Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had refused to proceed with the confirmation of Lynch, who would be the first African-American woman attorney general, until after the Senate passed the trafficking bill. But Democrats objected to a provision they say would have expanded a ban on federal funding for abortion by applying it to a victim's fund created by criminal fines. The compromise separates the victim's fund into two streams: criminal fines, which won't be used for health care, and health-related money subject to the existing ban on federal abortion funding. President Obama's criticized fellow Democrats who oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, or TPP. The 12-nation pact would encompass 40% of the global economy and is being negotiated in secret. In an interview on MSNBC, Obama responded to criticism from Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, who says the TPP would undermine U.S. sovereignty and help the rich get richer.
I love Elizabeth. We're allies on a whole host of issues, but she's wrong on this. Everything I do has been focused on how do we make sure the middle class is getting a fair deal. Now, I would not be doing this trade deal if I did not think it was good for the middle class. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
The Senate's expected to vote today on a bill that would grant President Obama so-called fast-track authority to negotiate the TPP, then present it to Congress for a yes or no vote, with no amendments allowed. The measure has received a growing chorus of protest, including from Democrats like Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who said his stance on fast-track is, quote, hell no. Public Citizen and the libertarian Cato Institute recently joined together to write an op-ed criticizing a component of the TPP that would allow corporations to sue countries in front of a tribunal of private attorneys if a law interferes with their claimed future profits. Quote, analysts with the Cato Institute and Public Citizen usually stand on opposing sides of trade policy issues, but we find common ground in opposing this system of special privileges for foreign firms, they wrote. The head of the Drug Enforcement Administration will retire next month following a scandal over reports DEA agents in Colombia participated in sex parties with prostitutes hired by drug cartels. Michelle Leonhardt has also opposed President Obama on marijuana policy, criticizing the Justice Department for deciding not to sue states that have legalized pot. The Drug Policy Alliance has launched a petition calling for Obama to appoint a replacement who will, quote, help reduce mass incarceration as a result of the failed war on drugs. The Justice Department has launched a civil rights investigation into the death of an African-American man a week after his spinal cord was severed in Baltimore police custody. At least 1,000 people rallied Tuesday at the site of the arrest of Freddie Gray. Police have released the names of the officers involved in his arrest, including the lieutenant who led the initial chase of Gray after he said Gray made eye contact with him, then ran away. According to The Guardian, Lieutenant Brian Rice has a history of domestic violence accusations. An attorney for Freddie Gray's family questioned Rice's decision to pursue Gray in the first place, saying, quote, running while black is not probable cause, felony running doesn't exist, and you can't arrest someone for looking you in the eye. Protesters who walked over 200 miles from Staten Island, New York, to Washington, D.C., to oppose police killings of unarmed people of color rallied at the U.S. Capitol Tuesday. Carmen Perez, an organizer of the 9-day March to Justice, said the march should be part of a larger cultural shift.
We can't just sit on our couches anymore. We can't wait for somebody to come save us. We have to save ourselves. And so that's what we're doing. One of the things that I feel is really important for people to understand is that the march is one of the tactics in a larger strategy. We need to change the hearts and minds of individuals. We need a cultural shift. We're coming with 3 pieces of federal legislation that are going to address police brutality and racial profiling, as well as invest back into our communities and our children.
In Detroit, Michigan, the police officer who shot and killed 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones in her own home during a night raid being filmed by a reality TV show has been reinstated for active duty. Joseph Weekly fatally shot Ayanna as she slept on the couch with her grandmother in 2010. 2 attempts to prosecute him resulted in hung juries. Detroit Police Chief James Craig told the Detroit News Weekly, "We'll operate on limited duty and won't work in the field." Here in New York, activists rallied at the office of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo Tuesday to call for him to reject a proposed deepwater port, which will be used to import natural gas. Patrick Robbins of Sane Energy Project said Cuomo should reject Port Ambrose and support renewable energy.
We're here today to tell Governor Cuomo to veto Port Ambrose, a liquefied natural gas port that would be built off the coast of Long Island. We have other options. We know that we could build offshore wind in that same area. That is what the people want. That is what they need. We want clean, renewable jobs. We're asking Governor Cuomo to stand with the people and not the private equity and the big banks that want Port Ambrose to be built.
The protests mark the 2nd of 3 days of action on climate change by Rising Tide NYC. On Monday, the group marked the 5th anniversary of the BP oil disaster. The explosion of the Deepwater Horizon rig on April 20, 2010, killed 11 workers and sparked the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. Kate McNeely and Anna Nogueira said they were standing in solidarity with Gulf Coast residents who continue to suffer from the spill's impacts.
Standing in solidarity with Gulf South communities that are asking BP to stop the oil spill that happened 5 years ago are not one-off things. It's going to happen again. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. We can no longer have our communities be sacrifice zones. There are alternatives.
Last month was the hottest March on record worldwide. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the first quarter of the year was the hottest start to any year on record, beating the previous high set in 2002. Arctic sea ice, meanwhile, hit its smallest extent for the month since record-keeping began 35 years ago. We'll have more on the environment as we mark Earth Day later in the broadcast. Actor Ben Affleck has apologized after hacked Sony emails published by WikiLeaks showed he asked that the revelation he had a slave-owning ancestor be omitted from the PBS documentary Finding Your Roots. In a post on social media, Affleck said he regretted the request but had been, quote, embarrassed by his link to a slave owner. The sentencing phase of the trial of convicted Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev has opened in Boston, with the jury to decide whether Tsarnaev faces the death penalty or life in prison. A pair of newlyweds who lost limbs in the bombings have become the latest to call on the federal government to drop its pursuit of the death penalty. In a statement, Jessica Kensky and Patrick Downs wrote, quote, "The defendant's objective on April 15, 2013, and our objective in deciding his punishment should not be one and the same. We must overcome the impulse for vengeance," they wrote. The parents of 8-year-old Martin Richard, who was killed in the attack, have also opposed the death penalty for Tsarnaev. And hundreds of students, educators and scholars from across the country have sent a letter to city authorities in Orange, New Jersey, urging them to reinstate a teacher suspended for letting her students write Get Well cards to imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer, but Amnesty International has found he was deprived of a fair trial. Speaking before the school board last week after her suspension, Marilyn Zuniga said her students wanted to send letters to Abu-Jamal after learning he was seriously ill.
On February 5th, I presented a Do Now that stated, "What is the main idea of this quote? So long as one just person is silenced, there is no justice."
Amen.
This quote
Amen.
Is by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
All right.
In April, I mentioned to my students that Mumia was very ill, and they told me they would like to write Get Well letters to Mumia. The most important fact to highlight in this entire matter is my love for and commitment to my students.
In their letter urging Zuniga's reinstatement, top educators and scholars, including Noam Chomsky, Mark Lamont Hill, and Kevin Kumashiro, dean of the University of San Francisco School of Education, wrote, quote, "It seems to us that we are at a moment in world history where it's important to encourage teachers to help their students develop empathy for others and to see themselves as people who want to strive to make the world a better place. How we pursue these aims is a legitimate question, but threatening to fire teachers who are trying to engage students' hearts seems to us to be profoundly wrong-headed," they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show with Doug Hughes, the U.S. mailman who made national headlines last week when he flew a tiny personal aircraft known as the gyrocopter onto the lawn of the U.S. Capitol in an act of civil disobedience. Hughes was carrying letters to every member of Congress, urging them to address corruption and to pass campaign finance reform. The letter began with a quote from John Kerry's farewell speech to the Senate. The unending chase for money, I believe, threatens to steal our democracy itself. Doug Hughes flew about an hour from Maryland into restricted airspace and onto the Capitol's West Lawn, stunning authorities and bystanders. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said Hughes literally flew below the radar, going undetected before landing on the Capitol lawn. Before taking off, Hughes had spoken about his plans to the Tampa Bay Times.
"I'm going to violate the no-fly zone nonviolently. I intend for nobody to get hurt. And I'm going to land on the Capitol Mall in front of the Capitol building. I'm going to have 535 letters strapped to the landing gear in boxes. And those letters are going to be addressed to every member of Congress. I don't believe that the authorities are going to shoot down a 60-year-old mailman in a flying bicycle."
After landing on the Capitol Mall, Doug Hughes was arrested and could now face up to 4 years in prison on charges of violating national defense airspace and operating an unregistered aircraft. Despite being under house arrest and forced to wear a GPS monitoring device, Doug Hughes has decided to keep speaking out about the need for campaign finance reform. He joins us now from his home in Ruskin, Florida, under house arrest. Doug Hughes, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
It's very good to have you with us. We're just going to try to bring up the sound of your microphone because we can hardly hear you. But can you describe what exactly you did?
Well, this stages for quite a while. A key part of my plan was...
It looks like we just lost Doug Hughes. Now we're getting him back on. You have to understand, we have a truck at his house because he is under house arrest inside as he sits inside in front of his piano. Let's go to Congress member Walter Jones of North Carolina, who took to the House floor and talked about the gyrocopter protest and the need for campaign finance reform.
Onto the Capitol lawn to make a point about influence of money in politics. While I don't condone violating restricted airspace and putting innocent people at risk by flying a gyrocopter on the Capitol lawn, Mr. Hughes does have a point about the pervasive influence of money in politics. I've seen it get worse and worse in my 20 years in Congress. The Citizens United decision by the United States Supreme Court in 2010 created super PACs and multimillionaires that buy candidates.
That was Republican Congressmember Walter Jones speaking of the on the floor of the House. One day after Doug Hughes landed his gyrocopter on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol, we spoke with Congressmember Alan Grayson about money and politics. Grayson's a Democrat representing Florida's 9th congressional district.
Member of the House of Representatives who raised most of his campaign funds in the last election from small contributions of less than $200. Thousands of people came to our website, congressmanwithguts.com, and made contributions. I'm one out of 435. On the other side of the building, over at the U.S. Senate, there's only one member of the U.S. Senate who raised most of his campaign from some small contributions. That's Bernie Sanders, who you heard earlier in this broadcast. That tells you something. In fact, to a large degree in both parties, because of the absence of campaign finance reform, the place is bought and paid for. And the only question is, do the members stay bought? That's what the corporate lobbyists stay up late at night wondering about. Is that member going to stay bought? Now, I was actually in the courtroom when this disastrous Citizens United decision was decided 5 years ago. Mitch McConnell was two seats to my left. We were the only public officials who were in the courtroom. Mitch McConnell was the happiest I have ever seen him that day. He was literally chortling when the decision was rendered. I said on MSNBC that night 5 years ago that if we do nothing, you can kiss this country goodbye. Well, pucker up, because right now the millionaires and the billionaires and the multinational corporations are calling the shots with whatever they want in TPP, whatever they want in Fast Track, more generally, whatever they want. They get the bailouts, they get the tax breaks, they get the so-called deregulation. They get what they want here because they get what they pay for.
That was Congressman Alan Grayson talking about campaign finance reform. Doug Hughes is a mailman from Florida who landed a personal aircraft known as a gyrocopter on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol last week. And we have him back in the feed. I want to ask you, Doug, were you surprised that you were able to get as far as you did onto the Capitol Mall?
Well, my expectation was that my letter would get through, they'd find out who I was, and the decision would be made that it's less dangerous to let me land since I'd already been vetted by the Secret Service and they knew I wasn't carrying a bomb. That didn't work, and it turned out I was able to land safely anyway.
Now, you did everything possible to warn folks ahead of time that you were doing this protest?
Yeah. I sent an email, which some people have said was inadequate, but the email gave the reasons why they didn't need to shoot me down. And I had a website, and on the website I asked people to call the White House to tell them to read the email. what address it went to and who it was from. And the Tampa Bay Times called in to the White House to tell them that I was coming in. So every effort was made to give the Homeland Security advance warning of my arrival and who I was and that I wasn't a threat.
So you fly under the radar, Doug Hughes, in this kind of flying bicycle contraption, a gyrocopter, and you land on the on the west lawn of the Capitol. You could have been blown out of the sky. Was Capitol finance reform that important to you?
Yes. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. And I can see the change over the decades as we slide from a democracy to a plutocracy. Just like Alan Grayson said, the fat cats are calling the shots. They're getting everything they want. And the voters know it. Across the political spectrum, center, left, and right, they know that this Congress isn't representing the people. And yes, it was worth risking my life. It was worth risking my freedom to get reforms so that Congress works for the people.
You're a letter carrier. You're a postal carrier, mailman. How many letters were you carrying in your gyrocopter to deliver to Congress?
I believe the count was 535, but I never actually counted them. I handle a lot of them in the process of printing them, signing them, stamping them. There was a lot of hours that went into getting the letters done.
Were you planning to hand-deliver them individually to each member of Congress?
No. At no time did I expect that was going to happen. The plan was to get the letters there in such a way that— Let me step back. Congress knows what's going on. I wasn't telling Congress anything that they're not aware of. I was telling them something they don't want the people to be aware of. And I was telling the people that there are solutions in place. They know there's a problem. I'm telling people something they don't know. There are solutions that have already been designed. They only have to be implemented, and it's in our power to implement them.
And could you talk about some of those solutions and what your letter actually said?
Well, what my letter actually said to the Congress critters was they've got to decide whether they're going to deny that corruption exists or they're going to pretend that they're doing something about it or they're going to really roll up their sleeves and be a part of reform. But I'm looking to the local media, particularly the print media, okay, at the local level, to hold the candidates' feet to the fire and force them to take a stand on real reform and whether or not they're going to vote for it or whether or not they're going to try and take a halfway mealy-mouthed stand on it, which means they're going to try and preserve the status quo. The idea is the voters can decide well if they're informed. The national media can't and won't inform the voters about where the candidates stand. But the local media, which has been, you know, very weak and impotent in the political process, can really take the ball, and they can be the moving force in informing the voters.
And can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your own evolution of your thinking? You were formerly in the U.S. Navy, served on the USS Enterprise. Talk about the evolution of your thinking on this issue.
Well, I wound up hanging out with a friend of mine, Mike Shanahan, and over a bunch of beers in his backyard, we came up with a written action plan, which we weren't able to take anywhere. That was called the Civilist Papers. But Mike came up with the idea that what we needed to do is take our written plan and send certified copies of it to every member of Congress. And that was the nucleus of the idea. But we observed that it wouldn't work because Congress already knows what we really need to do is get that letter to the public. They need to be aware. It was during the time that we were working on this, we discovered the existence of other groups and other very sophisticated plans that have been written by people a lot smarter than me. But we also observed these groups weren't getting any traction. they had managed to get through to the people who were sympathetic to the idea, but it wasn't going a lot further than that, nor could they get any attention in the media about what they wanted to do.
Earlier this month, Hillary Rodham Clinton kicked off her bid for the Democratic presidential nomination with her first formal campaigning in Iowa. And she talked about this issue, as she has for a few days now, campaign finance reform.
We need to fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if that takes a constitutional amendment.
Is that what you're calling for, Doug Hughes? Does that hearten you?
Yes. I'm glad to hear the candidates are talking about this. Cenk Ungar, who's a liberal media figure—
Cenk Uygur.
—has been working on an Article 5. Say again?
Cenk Uygur.
He's been working on an Article 5 convention, and this does an entire end-around on Congress so that Congress doesn't ever even vote on the amendment. It can be done completely through the states, through an Article 5 convention that would be called. The amendment would be designed. Then it goes back to the states, and three-quarters of the states have to ratify that constitutional amendment. At that point, it becomes law without the House or the Senate ever voting on it. So the states can put limits on the Congress, okay, and fix this problem so that there's no backsliding that would ever happen. The constitutional amendment can protect legislation from it being struck down by the courts. So this whole thing can happen, and it can stay.
Doug Hughes, are you encouraging other like-minded Americans who feel this way about campaign finance reform to come up with other creative ways to get the issue before the American public?
I'm absolutely sympathetic to other people getting involved with whatever their view on it is. I think we're going to see a lot of Trojan horse legislation and groups come up that are intended to misdirect people into solutions that have no power. Okay. I pretty much signed on to the Anti-Corruption Act, and I will look at other ideas that are out there, but the Anti-Corruption Act, which stands no chance of getting out of committee as we are right now, was written by a former head of the Federal Election Campaign, FEC. This guy is as far to the conservative end as Cenk Ungar is liberal, okay? That's why I say this thing completely goes across the political spectrum. But what this guy wrote will work if it's passed without any amendments. That's got to be a key part of this, is that they can't take this act that will work, cut out the key parts so that it has no teeth, and then say they pass reform.
Doug, one last question. Your son committed suicide last year. Did losing him in 2012, did losing him affect what you decided to do this year?
Yes. No, I wasn't trying to commit suicide, but his death was pointless. It was a waste, and he had so much potential. I looked at what I had done and accomplished and contributed, and I looked at how we're going to leave this country and this world if things go on the way they are. I've got kids. I've got two adult children, and I've got an 11-year-old daughter. I want to hand them a real democracy so that they have the power to control their destiny and their children's destiny. And right now, they're losing that. We're losing that. And it's in our power to restore democracy, and we can find the solutions to the problems that we have if the people have control.
Doug, we want to thank you for being with us. Doug Hughes is a postal carrier from Florida who landed a tiny personal aircraft known as a gyrocopter on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol last week in a protest to demand campaign finance reform. He was carrying letters to every member of Congress calling for them to address corruption. Hughes flew about an hour from Maryland into restricted airspace onto the Capitol's West Lawn, stunning authorities and bystanders. He's under house arrest. We're speaking to him at his home in Florida. He faces 4 years in prison. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Today is Earth Day. That's the theme song from the movie Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Today is Earth Day. It began in 1970 as a national teach-in on the crisis of the environment and has grown to become a worldwide day of action. 40 years ago, 1 in 10 Americans participated in Earth Day. Now more than 1 billion people celebrate it in more than 192 countries every year. This year's Earth Day comes as leading scientists have issued a, quote, Earth statement, warning that temperatures could rise by as much as 6 degrees centigrade by 2100, with catastrophic results if steps aren't taken to address climate change.
The statement includes a series of recommendations for the U.N. Climate Summit in Paris this December, saying, quote, if we do not act now, there is even a 1 in 10 risk of going beyond 6 centigrade by 2100. We would surely not accept such a high risk of disaster in other realms of society. As a comparison, such a 1 in 10 probability is the equivalent of tolerating about 10,000 airplane crashes every day worldwide, they wrote. In his weekly address, President Obama called climate change the greatest threat to the planet.
Wednesday is Earth Day, a day to appreciate and protect this precious planet we call home. And today, there is no greater threat to our planet than climate change. 2014 was the planet's warmest year on record. 14 of the 15 hottest years on record have all fallen in the first 15 years of this century. This winter was cold in parts of our country, as some folks in Congress like to point out. But around the world, it was the warmest ever recorded.
President Obama also said he would be visiting the Florida Everglades today to see how the environment is at risk from rising sea levels there. Well, we talk now to two of this year's Goldman winners, those winners of the Goldman Prize, the world's most prestigious award for grassroots environmental work. Phyllis Amido is the Africa 2015 Goldman Prize recipient, organized protests to close a lead plant in Mombasa, Kenya, that was exposing the community to toxic chemicals. Her son was one of those affected. She's the founder of the Center for Justice, Governance, and Environmental Action. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Phyllis. Congratulations on the Goldman Prize. Talk about the action you took in Kenya.
Thank you for having me on the program. What we did, what I did together with my colleagues, is that we mobilized the community to stand up for a right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment, which is guaranteed in the Kenyan constitution. But we realized that the state was asleep at the wheel, and therefore we needed to challenge the state to ensure this right for the community of Owino Uhuru.
And how did you first get involved in the movement? I understand you noticed that your son had gotten sick from lead poisoning.
Yes. My son, over the years, had periodically been with me at the plant because I'm a single mom. And a lot of the time, he had to come with me to the office after the babysitter's time to go off. And within those short periods that he spent with me, he contracted lead poisoning. And this got me thinking about the immediate community that the smelter is located within. And after my son was discharged from hospital, I went into the community and tested three children randomly, and they all tested positive for lead poisoning. So that was the first time that we started this campaign.
I wanted to turn to the testimony of Wandira, of Jacqueline Wandiri, a resident who lives near Mombasa.
My oldest son was having trouble breathing. By the time we reached the hospital, they discovered that his kidneys were failing. It was too late. He died soon after. All of the hope I had for my firstborn son and his life is gone. Now I'm left to worry about my youngest children.
That's Jacqueline Wandiri. We're speaking to Phyllis Omido. Your son was sick. Talk about how officials and the government and the company responded to your protests.
When we started this campaign, we didn't immediately start protesting. What we did is to create awareness around the issue by writing letters to the government officials. We wrote to the National Environment Management Authority. We wrote to Public Health. We visited their office and gave them the results of the tests that we have. And over the years, we continued to obtain tests on the soil, on the water, on the vegetation. And there was clear indications from 2008, the lead in the soil was 0.46 parts per million. In 2009, it was 1,600 parts per million. So we presented this documentation to the state agents, but what we received was resistance and cooperation. They were not willing to even look at the issues. Instead, they kept working with the smelter. They would go in and tell us they were going to investigate and come out and give us no feedback. So this is what left us no choice but to start protesting. And we did our first protest in 2009, where the whole community gathered, and we went on the roads to create awareness around this issue. And yes, there was a big traffic block on Mombasa-Nairobi Road at that time, which forced them to send the Assistant Minister for Environment to address us. But when he came to address us, what perplexed us was that he shared the podium with one of the local politicians who had shares in the smelter. And they told us that the smelter was there to create jobs and that all the noise we were making is because we are lazy and we didn't want to work. So this is what infuriated us even more, because we had already provided proof that there was something that was going wrong in the community.
And eventually you were and others were arrested as well. How did the final decision come to shut the smelter down?
Yes, in 2012, we were arrested and arraigned in court on charges of inciting violence and illegal gathering. After that, it led to 8 months of trial, listening to the state giving evidence against us, but we were acquitted. And after that, we did a petition. The community did a petition, and we sent it to the National Senate. And the Senate Committee on Health was asked to come and investigate our claims. They came into the community, and we provided them with the statistics we'd collected over the years. They also saw for themselves how bad the situation was. We showed them the graves that were started in the community because of the infant mortality that was so high. By the time they visited us in 2014, we had lost about 300 fetuses and newborn babies in the community. So that is when they issued, an order to the National Environment Management Authority that the smelter should not operate again.
And you've gone from being arrested to saving many children and people's lives from this potent neurotoxin, which is lead, to founding a center for justice, governance, and environmental action. Tonight, you will receive the Goldman Prize in Washington, D.C. What is this center doing now?
I realized when after we started working on the case in Owinohuru, that many other slum communities were going through the same issue. Just in the vicinity of Changamwe area in Mombasa, there were three smelters in total, all right in the middle of these slum communities in Mombasa. And so that is why I started the center, to assist these other communities, to assure them that the Constitution gives them a right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment, and that they must stand up and demand for it. And so far, the two other smelters were also shut with metal refinery. And we are also working with other communities who are going through the same issues of pollution and toxic waste being dumped within communities. So my center is working with that as well as mentoring the other upcoming generation. We are working with school children and helping the schools to start environment clubs as an extracurricular activity. And we are also working on policies with the Kenyan Senate, because we need policies passed that will address the evolving environment challenges in Kenya.
Well, Phyllis Omido, we want to thank you very much for being with us, winner of the 2015 Africa Goldman Prize. She's being referred to as the East African Erin Brockovich. She organized protests to close a lead plant in slum just outside of Mombasa, Kenya, that was exposing the community to toxic chemicals. Her son, one of those affected, and is founder of the Center for Justice, Governance, and Environmental Action. As we turn to a second Goldman Prize winner.
We want to turn now to Mint Zaw, who's a Burmese journalist and activist who used art to organize protests against a dam on the Irrawaddy River that would have displaced 18,000 indigenous people and impacted millions of more. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Tell us how you became involved in the issue of the dam.
As a journalist, I cover pretty much on the environmental issue of our country, and including rivers. So when you heard about that proposed mega dam in the very important watershed area of our main river inside the country, we are very much compelled to act. But back then, we are living under the military regime, quite oppressive military regime. So we move slowly, and we try to come up with the ideas and different approaches to raise awareness, to communicate the message across to the people.
I want to ask about some of the problems you faced while organizing opposition to the Myitsone Dam on the Irrawaddy River. This is social activist Kia Thu, who also participated in the protest.
To intimidate and suppress us, the intelligence service would try to find out who was organizing these events. Then they'd place us under surveillance.
Can you tell us, Mian Saw, who most benefits from the dam and who is most hurt by it, and where it is in Burma, with the military regime calls Myanmar?
Yeah. The proposed mega dam, it was the electricity generated from the dam, 90% will go to China, just the less than 10% for our country. But even then, that 10% and all these kind of agreement, the benefit will mainly go to the military, the official military regime, and not going to benefit to the people. But the negative impact is quite huge, not only for the people displaced by the dam, but also it's going to flood a very crucial, globally important biodiversity, by the biologically diverse area. And also what we worry most is the downstream impacts of the Brobos Dam, because this is the main artery. The Irrawaddy River is the main artery of our country, coming from the north to the south. They cover 60-70% of the country. So that's negative impact, because majority of our peoples are farmers and fishermen. So they need the healthy river. So the changes in the river flow were going to impact hugely to these majority rural population who reside along the Irrawaddy River. That's most worrying for us. And also, these proposed dams are located in the northern Burma or Myanmar, which is the ethnic, the Kachin people, their traditional area, and also their cultural heartland. So this is very much inappropriate in terms of the respect to the indigenous culture and their cultural heartland, also unacceptable for the people, for the downstream impacts and other negative environmental impact.
And Mian Zong, how are you able, as a journalist, especially given the enormous, overwhelming power of the military in your country, to get out the message and use art specifically to get out the message of the problems with the dam?
We wrote about the dams in other countries for the audience to get the comparison and some knowledge. But later on, we thought that we should express directly. And then we got an idea about the art gallery, because in our country, for that, we cannot, according to that military regime law, we cannot gather more than five people for any sort of activities, for the social activities or political activities. But they allow to have the art gallery. So we thought that this is a good place for us to gather people from different across the community, like artists and media and civil society leaders. And also they somehow relaxed to publish the gallery guidebook. But we changed that gallery guidebook in form of the publication that can raise awareness, that can communicate some basic sort of facts and figures and concept. And yeah, so this way we are working under the restriction and pushing a little bit by bit that limit of censorship and expanding the space available to us, which is back then is the art exhibit is a one place.
Well, Mian Zong, we want to thank you for being with us. Asia 2015 Goldman Prize recipient, also a Burmese journalist and activist who used art to organize protests against this mega dam on the Irrawaddy River that would have displaced 17,000 indigenous people and impacted millions more. And their struggle continues in Burma. This is Democracy Now! We'll continue our Earth Day special in a moment.
The first place we build alternatives is in our minds and in our hearts. Because our minds have been colonized. And the minute you can free your mind, all kinds of possibilities open up.
Shiva,
feminist activist, philosopher, thinker, analyst. We mobilize through scholarship. Science is narrowed by scientists. Critics say she's alarmist. My people are home, it's in danger. So what else can anyone call this? I place value in diversity, natural originality. Let the seed remain a mystery. Maintain nature's integrity. This isn't simply to feed, but our future guaranteed. All right, to exist and proceed. Move ahead.
Shiva, a new song written and performed by hip-hop artist Olmeca as an Earth Day tribute to Dr. Vandana Shiva. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
As we continue to mark Earth Day, we end today's show with a new report that finds at least two people working to save the environment were killed each week in 2014. In total, the group Global Witness documented the murders of at least 116 environmental activists last year.
3/4 of them were killed in Central and South America.
The report is called How Many More? It looks in detail at an activist who stood up to a mining project in one of the deadliest countries and survived. Her name is Berta Cáceres, and she's another winner of this year's Goldman Environmental Prize. This is Berta Cáceres describing how she helped organize indigenous communities in Honduras to resist a hydro dam on the Guacarque River because it could destroy their water supply.
In more than 150 indigenous assemblies, our community decided that it did not want that hydroelectric dam.
Berta filed complaints with the Honduran government and organized peaceful protests in the nation's capital. As her visibility increased, she became a target for the government.
Muchas denuncias. We denounced this dam and were threatened with smear campaigns, imprisonment, and murder. But nobody heard our voices until we set up a roadblock to take back control of our territory.
For well over a year, the Lenca maintained the roadblock with standing harassment and violent attacks. Tragically, Rio Blanca community leader Tomas Garcia was shot by the Honduran military at a peaceful protest.
Seeing this man murdered, the community became indignant, forcing a confrontation. The company was told that they had to get out.
We have 500 people here, and we are Rio Blanco comrades. We will defend Rio Blanco, and we will not let them pass.
And that is how Sinohydro left Rio Blanco. But it cost us in blood.
Honduran activist Berta Cáceres, who won the 2015 Goldman Prize as well. For more, we're joined by Billy Kite, campaigner for Global Witness, author of their new report, How Many More? As it went to press, 3 more environmental and land activists were killed in Latin America in the space of 3 days. Billy, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out for us this report and what you have found.
Sure. So we found last year that over 116 people that we know about were killed defending their rights to the environment and land. A shocking 40% of those victims were indigenous communities. So we're seeing more and more that the competition for natural resources is intensifying and having very disastrous effects.
And why so many in Central and South America being killed?
Well, there's a long history of social conflicts and social movements in Central and South America. There's also—it's a very resource-rich region, and many marginalized groups, for instance, indigenous peoples, are being targeted for the fact their lands are very rich in commodities, which are wanted by companies and political and economic interests. It's also an area where civil society is very strong, which has a double-edged sword. One, it means they're more exposed to violence and conflict around the defense of the environment and land, but also it means that they are better at monitoring these issues. So although it is a global problem, we certainly see that South America is where it's been hardest hit.
Well, talk about the 3 indigenous Tolupan leaders who were gunned down during an anti-mining protest in northern Honduras. They'd received death threats warning them to stop their attempts to protect the environment.
So these were indigenous leaders who stood up against illegal mining and illegal logging in their communities. And they were gunned down, as you say, at a peaceful sit-in protest to stop checking cars being filled up with illegal timber and minerals from their communities. And they then left the community for 6 months. They were granted emergency protection measures by the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. They returned after 6 months back to their community. But the perpetrators are still at large. They're still walking freely in the village without, even though they have police arrest warrants out for them. And even, you know, a couple of weeks ago, one of the leaders who'd been threatened was killed. And this person had protection measures from the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. So it's still very much an ongoing crisis in that area.
Can you tell us a little more about the 2015 Goldman Prize winner who we just played a clip of, Berta Cáceres, and her significance in what she's doing in Honduras?
Well, she's an emblematic case. I mean, she's a very courageous activist. She fights for indigenous rights, but also women's rights as well. Her leadership in COPIN, the indigenous network in Honduras, has been inspirational for many, many people. She's suffered threats against her life. Two of her children have had to flee the country because of these threats. She continued to receive threats. Even recently, she received tentative plans to kidnap her. And despite this, she still struggles on with the fight to protect indigenous areas and the rivers of the Rio Blanco community.
And what is the responsibility of international bodies or governments on this issue of continuing killings of environmental activists around the world?
Well, our report has shown there's been a 20% increase last year from the previous year. And of these killings, this is almost double the amount of journalists killed in the same period, but it doesn't have the same amount of attention. This is a hidden crisis which people need to monitor. International bodies need to really stand up and have a real wake-up call and realize that this is an issue. And what needs to happen is that governments need to make sure that perpetrators are accountable, that the problem is monitored systematically, that people are actually put in jail for these crimes, and the heightened risk posed to these environmental land rights activists is recognized. For instance, a Human Rights Council resolution would be helpful as a starting point to really put pressure on governments to act and bring perpetrators to account. Impunity breeds violence, and the environment is now seen as a key battleground for human rights, and people are dying every day for the protection of these rights.
In countries that are seen to have somewhat progressive leaders, like Evo Morales in Bolivia or Rafael Correa in Ecuador, in these particular countries, there's huge battles with the government and indigenous rights activists, environmental activists around the extractive industries and the governments relying on this. Can you talk about this?
Sure. So I think those governments, we have to be careful because they have two different discourses. One is the domestic audience, one is the international audience. Internationally, they're seen as the kind of purveyors of Madre Tierra, you know, Pachamama, Mother Earth. But actually, the reality is that they are selling off a lot of their country's resources, particularly in the Amazon region, for instance. An Ecuadorian activist was killed during the UN climate change conference in Lima last year, for instance, and there are links to his activism and to the fact that he was murdered. So, yes, we are seeing a lot of resource-rich areas being sold often in secret resource deals, and this really must end. That's where the kind of crux of the problem, the fact that governments and companies are allowing indigenous land, other communities' territories to be sold off to the highest bidder.
And you mentioned the Amazon, the key role of the Amazon in the fight to save our Earth, and the activism there. Has there been any reduction in the violence against environmental activists in that region of the world?
I wouldn't say so, no. I mean, just literally in November, December last year, four indigenous leaders in the Peruvian Amazon were killed by illegal loggers. And now these people, Edmund Schotta and his compatriots, have been fighting for the official recognition of land title for their areas, of their indigenous communities, for almost over 10, 15 years. And the Peruvian government refused to officially recognize their land title, even though this had been promised over a long period of time. So illegal loggers were able to take advantage of this vacuum of power in those areas and illegally log in their communities. And anyone who stands up, like Edmund Schotta and his colleagues, were killed. So, no, it's particularly prevalent in the Amazon, and it's an issue which will continue to be seen
Billy
on the airwaves.
We want to thank you for being with us, Campaigner for Global Witness. We'll link to your report, How Many More?, which documents the killing of environmental activists worldwide. I'll be speaking at Colorado College Thursday night at 7 o'clock. Check our website, and we'll be broadcasting from The Hague Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkaf, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman.